Please be seated. Well, it's really, really good to be back with you this morning. Denise and I had the privilege of spending a week in New York City with our son who lives there. He was able to show us the ins and outs of Greenwich Village and the wonderful jazz shows that are there. And we got to see Stereophonics, which is a Broadway, off-Broadway production starring a famous Canadian's music, Will Butler from Arcade Fire, which was fun. And just the atmosphere in New York City, we arrived the night of the election, was very, very interesting in the days following what happened. And then Denise came back home, went back to work, and I went to Arizona to play golf with my buddy. And that was a completely different atmosphere in Arizona. Just people upbeat, you know, the economy's gonna turn around, all's right with the world. So it was very interesting to just be in divided America, see it bifocally, if you will. So 100 years ago, 1925, actually, Pope Pius the 11th. Just thank God you don't have the name Pius. Instituted the feast day, which he called the Solemnity of Our Lord Jesus Christ, King of the Universe. It was and remains the latest edition of the church year, and in the 1960s was renamed the Feast of the Reign of Christ, a title that better reflects, it was felt, the Gospels in which Jesus witnesses to an ongoing effect of God's reign and does not claim the throne just as a bald statement. In 1925, the world was reeling from the effects of the Great War. Rebuilding efforts were ongoing, but they seemed so feeble compared to what it had wrought. The destruction and dismemberment of an entire generation of young men, European young men, and many, of course, in the Middle East as well. And all of those knock-on effects that happen when such a catastrophe goes down on women and children and the wider society. In his modernist classic, The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot asked in poetry, "What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish?" Yeats had said during World War I, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed on the world." In this sense of vertigo, people reacted differently, two main ways. The first was to party hard. You've no doubt read Great Gatsby, Fitzgerald's famous work. Time of deliberate forgetfulness, hedonism, sexual experimentation, increasing prosperity for the elites. And those same elites giving up on organized religion. At the same time, and this you can see in the newspaper headlines of the day, it was a reactionary age. A time of anti-immigrant feeling, a time of racial segregation in both the United States and Canada. In the United States, the Ku Klux Klan boasted 5 million members. They were easily the largest fraternal organization in both the U.S. and Canada. And I was privileged to serve in the city of Moose Jaw, which was the epicenter 100 years ago of the Ku Klux Klan movement in Canada. In Europe, Adolf Hitler had just published the first volume of Mein Kampf, My Struggle, in which he explicitly detailed his descent into anti-Semitism, and his clearly laid out plans for living space, European domination, and then world domination. Pope Pius realized that the world was at a kind of tipping point, in which after the long run of Christendom and the Enlightenment, the values of Christ, the idea of Christ as the one holding the world together, no longer had the power it once had. And the values of nationalism and secularism were seen as more promising. Outlined this way, the crises of today take on a different hue. Many are arguing, as I would probably argue, that they're really a continuation of everything that was birthed in that period. 100 years is, we forget, just a drop in the chronological bucket. Several generations now have lived and are living in this moment. Pius, no doubt, hoped, for he was nothing, as his name suggests, if nothing but a conservative, that a specific focus on Christ's kingdom in that moment would help Christians everywhere ask the question, why is the church not my home? Why am I being enamored by secularism, by nationalism? But by the time the feast was renamed and placed as the last Sunday of the church year in 1968, another year of riots, assassinations, momentous elections in both Canada and the U.S., and an ongoing conflict in Asia, the perennial question had become, how is it possible that Christ is reigning in all of this mess? In 1968, people were asking, well, why speak of king and kingdom or reign at all? All we need is power to the people. It's democracy that will save the world, isn't it? And it sure did seem so at the time. Now, of course, the questions have morphed one step further. If democracy as an institution is as fragile, as dysfunctional, and self-serving as we think it is becoming, the one thing we thought we could rely on to bring about the kind of change we all hope for, then where's the hope? How's it going to happen? Into this cauldron of questions and doubts, we drop the confrontation between Christ and the reigning nationalism of the day, Caesar's Rome, in the person of Pilate, the governor. When Jesus is handed over to him, Pilate doesn't really know what to do with him. He's not robbed anyone. He's not killed anyone. He's not committed treason, at least by Roman law. Pilate thinks he's a pretender to the Jewish throne, but note that Jesus is, in his answers to Pilate, actively subverting Pilate's categories, all human categories of tribal and national power. His kingdom is not of this world, yet it is clearly for the sake of this world. For all can be part of it. Take that literally. All can be part of it. No boundaries. Indeed, all belong to it, with this one caveat, if they belong to the truth. What a strange phrase, right? Probably the strangest definition of a kingdom ever offered. There are no colonies, no people farther away from or closer to the center of power. There are none who benefit from being educated or uneducated. There's no socioeconomic distinction whatsoever. Just all who belong to the truth. And it's offered up by a man who appears to have absolutely nothing going for him. He's a carpenter. He has no educational credentials. He has no financial backing. He's under extreme duress, with the jaws of torture and crucifixion staring him in the face. So, rather than a throwaway line at the end of our text, we need to take Pilate's question with the seriousness it deserves. What is truth? In essence, Pilate is asking, how can I make sense of these words that you're speaking? What does it mean to belong to the truth? Who are you, Jesus of Nazareth? Most people don't try to answer that question. They shrug their shoulders and walk away. If they do try to answer it, maybe like Pilate, they assume that truth is that which is decided by those who have the power to enforce their will, those with political, economic, and military means. They're the ones who decide what truth is, for as we know, it's the victors that write the history books. But that's the road that leads to oppression. As we know, if the 20th century taught us anything, this we know. To simply live with the misinformation and lies of the powers that be, to throw up our hands and party hard, or become reactionary to the immigrant, or the truth of climate change, or that the billionaires are constructing our society not for our benefit, but for their own, will be, whether today or tomorrow or sometime in the near future, an inadvertent yes to an injustice that will reverberate down to future generations. But the good news of the gospel is that in the face of the realities of the last 100 years, it is not only possible to belong to the truth, right here and right now, it's our greatest joy as well as our greatest calling. Indeed, one of the central purposes of this community here this morning, not just this morning, but as an ongoing reality, is to support each other in the midst of a confusing, troubling time, and to find in our lives, together and wherever God calls us, a beauty and a joy that bubbles over. To help each other, whether our children or our youth or our young adults or those of us of a mature age, discover ongoing renewal and hope. I was casting about for some practical story that would illustrate what I'm trying to describe. Realize it's been kind of abstract. Yesterday afternoon, I was wandering about on Mount Newton trying to think of something, and I've discovered this set of trails near our townhouse, and I met a couple yesterday who had never been on the mountain. They were new to the mountain, and they were trying to make heads or tails of the signage because it was kind of confusing for them. And I've seen this before, but sometimes people are about to take a left turn and go further on into the bush. And I said to them, do you know about the bluffs? They said, no, we don't know about the bluffs. And I could see their eyes brighten. Well, just instead of going left, which is going to take you quite a ways off, maybe you want to go there. I'm not going to tell you what to do. But maybe you want to take a right and then stay right at the next fork in the road as well, and you'll come to the most marvelous view. It's an extraordinary view. You can see Sydney off to the left, you can see Cordova Bay, and you can see all these islands in front of you. And they were like, wow, thanks. That's what we're gonna do. Some, no doubt, out of politeness in the past, when I've said these same words to them, have no intention of taking my suggestion. But I always smile, as I did yesterday, imagining those who will. For though I have nothing to do with the beauty they'll discover, nor anything to do with the memory that will be made, I have witnessed to something, testified, if you will, to a truth that I've discovered and get to live in week by week. To belong to the truth means not that we are right, whereas others are wrong, but that we have discovered a path that opens onto great beauty, onto a path that will become increasingly more solid, more real, more oriented to justice, the more we explore it. Jesus testifies to this truth by undermining the claim that truth is something the clever discover or the powerful decide. The truth is Christ opening a path for the world, a path of extraordinary mercy, grace, and forgiveness. In the next years, we will find a continuation of the moment we've been in for over a century. People of all religions and all political persuasions will be tested and sifted. From a human perspective, kingdoms will continue to rise and they will fall, as Daniel in our first reading said. The center really does not hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world time and time again. But there is one who, like a human one, ascends in the midst of it all, quietly, through death, through service, to take his place beside the Ancient of Days. He's seen all our moments. He's seen what love can do. It's unconquerable. Amen.